The Verdict by Howard Jones.
Hello, Kate Matthews speaking. Oh, I'm sorry to hear about that, Mrs. Talbot. I hope that you'll be better soon. Please make another appointment with my secretary when you're ready. Goodbye. An ordinary phone call, one of the millions made every day, and one of the billions made since that first one on the 10th of March, 1876. Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you. The words of Alexander Graham Bell as he tried out his new invention by calling his assistant in the next room. The telephone. The saver of countless lives when used properly to quickly call emergency services. When used improperly, the cause of deaths on the road, and on a much less serious level, the cause of great annoyance in its mobile form, given the banal conversations overheard in the vegetable aisle of the supermarket or on the train. I'm by the potatoes. Do you want Minister Piper or King Edward's? In a busy town centre, it had also become necessary to develop a sidestep worthy of an international fly-half to avoid people avidly studying their phones. I am a lawyer, specialising in divorce and family law, and based in Liverpool. Not a very happy branch of the legal profession, but then what is? Maybe conveyancing as people buy the home of their dreams if they can find the deposit and survive the stress. Much of my time was spent in the family court representing one half of a former relationship, whether it was a marriage or one of the alternatives available these days, as they battled over residence and contact with the children. It always strikes me as odd that people are prepared to let complete strangers in the form of a judge or magistrates decide the future of their children. On the other hand, a clear mind, unhampered by emotion, is often essential, as sadly demonstrated in a recent high-profile case concerning a terminally ill baby. By way of a hobby of interest of mine is looking back over old criminal law cases, especially those between the wars. A telephone call featured very prominently in a case that I recently researched.
Liverpool Central Chess Club.
Is Mr. Wallace there?
Not at the moment.
Is he going to be there, do you know?
He should be here later. Can you telephone later?
No, it's my daughter's 21st birthday and I'll be too busy. Can I leave a message for him?
Yeah. What's your name?
Qualtro. That's Qualtrough. R.M. Qualtro. Would you ask him to come to 25 Menlo of Garnes East at 7:30 tomorrow night, as there may be some business for him?
I'll give him that message if he comes in. Goodbye.
The phone call and message was taken by Samuel Beattie, the club captain, at around 7:15, who duly gave the message to Wallace some 30 minutes later. The recipient of the message was William Herbert Wallace, who was born in Milham in Cambria in 1878. As a young man, he spent some time working in India and then China in the drapery business. He had, however, a recurring kidney problem, and he returned home and had a kidney removed at Guy's Hospital. In 1914, he was engaged as the Liberal Party agent in Harrogate, and it was there that he married Julia Dennis, who was thought to be the same age as Wallace, but it later transpired that she was 17 years older. The declaration of war meant that political activity was suspended. Wallace therefore obtained a post at the Prudential Assurance Company in Liverpool as an agent, where he was still employed at the time of the phone message on the 19th of January 1931. He was also a part-time lecturer in chemistry at a college in Liverpool. His interests include science, playing chess, and accompanying his wife on the violin as she played the piano at their home at 29 Wolverton Street, Anfield. He was a tall, rather thin individual with grey hair that was receding, a moustache and steel-rimmed glasses. He had a somewhat aloof, reserved manner. The next day, Wallace went about his business as usual, and according to a statement he made later to the police, he returned home at 6 p.m. He then stated that he left home at about 6:45 to go to Menlove Gardens East to see a Mr. Qualtrough. A tram conductor, later, gave evidence that Wallace got on his tram at 7:06. When he arrived, he established that whilst there was South, North and West Menlove Gardens, there was no Menlove Gardens East. He made inquiries with several people, including a policeman, explaining that he was an insurance agent looking for a Mr. Qualtrough. The policeman suggested that he tried Menlove Avenue, whereupon Wallace drew out his pocket watch, as did the policeman, and they agreed that it was 7:45. After making further inquiries at a shop, Wallace returned home. As he got home, his next-door neighbours, Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, were just going out, and the following conversation took place in the alleyway at the rear of the houses.
Good evening, Mr. Wallace.
Have you heard anything unusual tonight?
No. Why? Has anything happened?
I've been around to the front door and the back, but I can't get in. The doors are fastened against me. She won't have gone out. She has a cold.
Try the back door again. If it doesn't open, I'll get my back door key and try it.
It opens now.
The Johnsons later gave evidence that Wallace went into the house and they heard him call out a couple of times, and the light was turned up in the little bedroom and a match was struck. About a minute and a half later, Wallace hurried out and said, "Come and see, she has been killed." They followed Wallace into the house and found the fully clothed body of Julia lying in the sitting room. She had suffered several blows to the head and was lying next to a blood-soaked Macintosh, later confirmed as belonging to Mr. Wallace. Mr. Johnson went to fetch the police while Mrs. Johnson stayed with Wallace. Constable Williams, on duty in the area, knocked on the front door, which was opened by Wallace.
"Something terrible has happened here."
Wallace took the constable into the room where the body was. It felt warm to the touch, but there was no pulse. The policeman spoke to Wallace.
"How did this happen?"
"I do not know. I left the house at 6:45 to go to the Menlove Gardens East, and my wife accompanied me to the back yard door. She walked a little way down the entry with me, and then returned and bolted the back yard door. She would then be alone in the house. I went to Menlove Gardens and found that the address given to me was wrong. Becoming suspicious, I returned home and went to the front door. I inserted my key in the front door to find I could not open it. I went to the back entry door. It was closed and not bolted. I went up the yard to try the back kitchen door, but it would not open. I went again to the front door, but this time found it bolted. I hurried round to the back again and up the back yard and found that it would open. I entered the house, and this is what I found."
The constable then went with Wallace to examine the rest of the house. The constable asked Wallace about the light in the middle bedroom.
Was this light burning when you came in?
I changed myself in this room before leaving.
The constable then noticed an ornament on the mantelpiece from which several £1 notes were protruding, to which Wallace commented, "Here is some money they haven't touched." They then examined the rest of the room. Julia's clothes were in a curtain recess and appeared untouched, as were the contents of the back bedroom used as a laboratory. In the front bedroom, the bedclothes were half off the bed and pillows were lying near the fireplace. The drawers of the dressing table and wardrobe were closed. They then went down to the kitchen and noticed that the doors of a small cabinet were broken. In there was a small cash box, which Wallace examined and said that £4 was missing. A lady's handbag was on a chair. Wallace looked in it and found a £1 note and some change. Sergeant Breslin then arrived, and they went into the living room, where the constable spoke to Wallace.
That looks like a Macintosh.
Yes, it's an old one of mine. It usually hangs in the hall.
At 9:50, a Professor McFall arrived to carry out a forensic examination of the scene and concluded that death had occurred at around 6 p.m. But there could be a margin of error either way. Later that night, Dr. Hugh Pierce arrived and, after observing the onset of rigor mortis, concluded that death had occurred around 6 p.m. But when later cross-examined, accepted that there could be a margin of 2 hours either side, but definitely not after 8 p.m. Apart from the blood on the body and the Macintosh, only one spot of blood was found in the toilet upstairs. When Wallace's clothing was forensically examined, no trace of blood was found. Over the next 2 weeks, the police carried out various inquiries until they arrested Wallace and charged him with his wife's murder. Wallace made 2 voluntary statements, but was not questioned in any detail. The police theory was that Wallace had made the telephone call himself. It was established that the call had been made from a call box some 400 yards from his house to create an alibi for the following night. They also carried out tests to confirm that he could have killed Julia, left the house, and appeared at the tram stop by 7:06 at the latest. Julia had been seen alive at 6:30 by a milk delivery boy, although other evidence suggested that it could have been a few minutes later. A young, reasonably fit policeman reenacted the murder, changed his clothes and ran to the tram stop. The police came to the conclusion that Wallace had taken his clothes off, put on the Macintosh to commit the murder, and then changed back into his clothes. He had also created the impression that a robbery had taken place before making his way to the tram stop. After preliminary hearings at the police court, where he was remanded in custody, the matter was set for trial at Liverpool Assizes on the 22nd of April before Mr. Justice Wright. Mr. E.G. Hemmerid, K.C., would lead for the prosecution, and Mr. Roland Oliver, K.C., for the defence. The assizes were held in St. George's Hall, a large neoclassical building in Lime Street, which I pass every day on my way to my office. The oak-panelled courtroom is often used to represent the Old Bailey in TV dramas, as it has not been used since 1984. The key pieces of evidence would concern, firstly, who made the phone call. Secondly, the time scales, i.e., was it physically possible for Wallace to have killed Julia and still been in the area of Menlove Gardens at the time confirmed by several people that he spoke to? The examination in chief and cross-examination of Samuel Beattie were key. Mr. Hemmerid rose to address the witness.
I'm a cotton broker's manager, and I'm a member of the Central Liverpool Chess Club, which meets at the City Cafe. I'm the captain of the club, which meets on Mondays and Thursdays during the winter. I have known the defendant for 8 years.
Was the defendant in the habit of appearing on both of those nights?
He was not a regular attender, sometimes once, twice if there was a match on, but most likely once.
I believe that there is a notice pinned on the board showing when people should be there to play in a competition.
That does not mean that they will be there, only that they are scheduled to be.
What time does it usually meet?
It is an open cafe. They should start by 7:45, but they can start earlier.
What time did you arrive on the 19th of January?
About 6 p.m.
There was a telephone call, I understand. What time was that?
About 7:15 p.m. or shortly after.
You took no notice at the time?
No, my lord.
It was sometime after 7 p.m.
Yes, my lord.
Was it a man or a woman on the telephone?
A man.
What sort of voice was it?
A strong voice, a rather gruff voice.
Did you take a message from him?
I did.
Did you see the accused in the cafe later that evening?
I did.
What time was that?
About half an hour later, say 7:45.
Well, what was he doing?
He had started a chess game.
Did you speak to him?
Yes, I said that I had a telephone message for him from a Mr. Qualtro. He said, "Qualtro, Qualtro, who is this Qualtro?" I then gave him the envelope on which I had written the caller's name and address.
Did you tell him what the caller wanted?
Yes, I said that Mr. Qualtro wished to see him tomorrow evening at 7:30 at 25 Men Love Gardens East. It is something in the nature of your business, he said. I don't know the chap. Where is Men Love Gardens East? Is it Men Love Avenue? I said, no, Men Love Gardens East, and he said that he did not know where it was, but he could always ask.
Did he write the address down?
Yes.
Was there anything else that evening?
No, that was it.
Did you see him again on the 22nd of January, that is 3 nights later?
Yes, a club member called Cade told me at about 10:20 that Wallace was on the corner of Lord Street.
Did you speak to him?
Yes, my lord. He said to me, oh, that telephone message. Can you remember definitely what time you received that message? I said, well, 7 or shortly after.
Did he say anything else?
Yes, he said, cannot you get a bit nearer than that? It is important to me. I said, I'm sorry, but I cannot.
After that, did he say where he had come from?
He said that he had just come from the police and they had cleared him. I said that was, I was very pleased about that.
Beattie was then cross-examined by Roland Oliver for the defence.
Is it right that there is a club notice board which shows that the dates of chess matches to be played in the competition?
Yes.
Was the defendant scheduled to be there on the 19th of January?
Yes.
So that anyone in the cafe, if they were interested, could see who was due to be there?
Yes.
The matches must begin by 7:45, although they can start earlier.
Yes.
I'm interested in the voice that addressed you on the telephone that evening. Could you reproduce the conversation that you had with it?
Yes, partly.
I'm particularly interested in what the voice told you about the business, whatever it was. Can you remember what the voice said about that?
I told him that Wallace should be coming to the club later, and could he ring again? He said that he could not, as it was his daughter's 21st birthday, and I want to see Wallace on a matter of business. It is something in the nature of his business.
In addition to that conversation, you asked him to spell Qualtro and to give you the address. So altogether, you had quite a conversation.
Yes, I should say so.
At the police court, you said that it was a strong and gruff voice and confident, not hesitant.
Yes.
Was it, so far as you could judge, a natural voice?
That is difficult to judge.
I know it is. But did you have any reason to think that it was not natural at the time?
No, I had no reason to think that.
Do you know Mr. Wallace's voice well?
Yes.
Did it occur to you that it was anything like his voice?
Certainly not.
Does it occur to you now that it was anything like his voice? It
would be a great stretch of the imagination to say anything like that.
Did Mr. Wallace suggest to you that he did not know Menlove Avenue?
No.
Menlove Gardens could be anywhere along Menlove Avenue to a man who did not know where it was, I suppose.
I suppose.
I want to know what his demeanour was and when you gave him the message. Was he playing chess?
Yes.
Did he appear to be interested in the game?
Yes, I had to attract his attention.
I understand that the game went on until 10 minutes past 10?
I believe so. I am told so. I did not see him leave.
So if it is right that the game finished at 10 minutes past 10, it would mean that he had to struggle for something like 2.5 hours and then won.
Quite so.
A number of witnesses were called by the prosecution. Their evidence and cross-examination can be summarised as follows. James Caird confirmed that he had known Wallace for 15 years as a fellow member of the chess club and was present when Samuel Beattie gave Wallace the message and the discussion about Quartro and the whereabouts of the address. After leaving the club together, Wallace again raised the issue of where Mengov Gardens East was. He considered him to be a placid, intellectual man. He also knew Mrs. Wallace and considered them to be a very happy couple. James Edward Rothwell, a police constable, stated that he had seen Wallace at 3:30 p.m. on the 20th, and he appeared to be very distressed and was wiping his eyes as if he had suffered a bereavement. His face was haggard and drawn, as if he had been crying. He had known Wallace for about 2 years and passed quite close to him. Alan Croxton Close, a 14-year-old milk boy who said that he had delivered milk to the Wallace house at 6:30 on the 20th of January and had seen Mrs. Wallace and had spoken to her. Thomas Phillips, a tram conductor, who stated that before getting on the tram and twice during the journey, Wallace had asked him 3 times if the tram went to Menlove Gardens. He told him to change at Penny Lane to take another tram. He said that Wallace boarded the tram at 7:06. Arthur Thompson, another tram conductor, confirmed that Wallace had boarded his tram at 7:15 and asked to be put off at Menlove Gardens, as he was a stranger to the area. Wallace asked him several times whether the train went to Menlove Gardens East. When the tram reached Menlove Gardens West, he told Wallace to get off there as Menlove Gardens East probably ran in the opposite direction. Katie Mather confirmed that the defendant called at her house at 25 Menlove Gardens West and asked if it was Menlove Gardens East. When told it wasn't, he left. PC Sergeant was on duty near Menlove Avenue at about 7:40 when the defendant approached him, seeking directions to Menlove Gardens East. He was advised to try Menlove Avenue and directed him there. He then asked where he could find a directory and was told the post office or police station. He then told me that he had received a message from a Mr. Qualtro, as he was an insurance agent. He then took out his pocket watch and said that it was not yet 8 p.m. The PC looked at his own watch and said that it was only 1:45. Lily Pinches stated that the defendant went into her newsagent's sweet shop at 8:10 p.m. and asked to see a directory. She produced one and the defendant examined it before discussing whether there was a Menlove Gardens East and was told there wasn't. He left after about 10 minutes. Joseph Crewe had known Wallace for about 12 years as his superintendent at the Prudential, but also in a private capacity, as he had given Wallace violin lessons for a short time at his house in the general area of Menlove Avenue. He confirmed that Wallace was a scrupulously honest man of placid temperament. He also knew Mrs. Wallace and considered their relationship to be the best possible. He also gave details of the arrangements for handing over premiums collected. This would normally be done on a Wednesday afternoon and would include the collection from Wednesday morning. The amount could be from £30 to £40. Anyone familiar with his working habits would know that he would have the bulk of his collection on Tuesday evening. Jane Draper worked as a cleaner for Mr. and Mrs. Wallace and stated that a small poker and iron bar were missing from the house, but that her last visit was on the 7th of January. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, the next-door neighbours, gave evidence about meeting Wallace and discovering the body. They were asked about the Wallaces' relationship and confirmed that they seemed to be a happy couple and that they had never heard arguments through the adjoining walls. Mrs. Johnson was asked about Wallace's demeanour while she was alone with him after her husband went for the police, and she stated that he seemed agitated and anxious and close to breaking down, but recovered his composure. James Sargerson, a locksmith, stated that the front door lock was worn and appeared to have been so for a long time. It allowed the latch to slip back on. The back door lock was rusty but in working order, but needed pressure to open it. Professor John McFall stated that, in his opinion, the death occurred at around 6 p.m. but there could be a margin of error either way, which he put at 1 hour. He went on to say that 11 blows had been struck. When asked about the prisoner's demeanour, he said it was abnormal in the sense that he was too collected and calm in the circumstances. He was of the opinion that the blows had been struck in a frenzy. Roland Oliver was quick to point out that the defendant had been sane for 52 years and was assessed as such by experts during his time in custody. Dr. Hugh Pierce also examined the body and gave the time of death as around 6 p.m, but suggested that there could be a margin of error of up to 2 hours either way, but in any event, not after 8 p.m. That completed the prosecution case, other than evidence from the police. After an opening statement, Roland Oliver called his client as a witness, something he was not obliged to do as Wallace had given several statements to the police, but Oliver's judgment was that it would be to his client's advantage to give evidence in court and to be cross-examined by the prosecution.
Is your full name William Herbert Wallace?
Yes, it is.
How long have you been living at Wolverton Street?
16 years.
How long had you been married at the time of your wife's death?
18 years.
How old are you?
52.
You have worked for the Prudential since 1915.
Yes.
What were your relations with your wife?
I should say perfect.
Were you in any sort of financial difficulty?
Not at all.
I believe that you had £152 in your account.
Yes.
Had you any motive whatever for the death of your wife?
None whatever.
You belong to the chess club, and notices there show dates and names of persons playing.
Yes.
Your round for the Prudential is quite large.
Yes. I would make about 560 calls a week.
On the 20th of January, how much had you collected?
About £14, but I paid out £10 for sick pay. I had paid in the previous Thursday. Did not collect on Friday or Saturday, so I had less than normal. I had a touch of flu.
You kept the money in a small cash box in your bedroom?
Yes.
You also kept a small amount of money in a jar?
Yes. We kept a few pounds for going out, for convenience. We also took the money, including the company's money, with us if we went out.
Did you have any sort of quarrel with your wife on the 19th of January?
No.
What time did you leave to go to the chess club?
As near as I can tell you, about 7:15.
How did you get there?
I walked up to Belmont Road and caught a tram.
It has been suggested that you used a telephone box to telephone a message to yourself. Is there a word of truth in that?
Absolutely not.
On the 20th of January, you collected all day until just before 6 p.m?
Yes, and then I went home for tea with my wife.
A policeman has suggested that he saw you at 3:30 that afternoon, wiping your eyes in your sleeve and looking ghastly. Is that true?
No. My eyes may have watered, but I wouldn't have wiped them on my handkerchief.
You had tea with your wife. What time did you leave for Menlove Gardens East?
At about 6:45.
When you left, was your wife alive?
Certainly.
You told the police that you arrived in the area of Menlove Avenue at 7:20.
Yes.
Then you searched the area, asking a number of people where Menlove Gardens East was, including a policeman with whom you agreed that it was 7:45.
Yes.
After making inquiries in the newsagents, you caught a tram to return home.
Yes.
And what time was that?
I should say a few minutes after 8 p.m. I arrived home at 8:45.
Did you try your front door?
Yes, it was locked. And then I tried the back door, but it would not open, so I knocked, but got no reply. I thought my wife must be upstairs. She had not been well with the cold.
Then your next-door neighbours appeared on their way out.
Yes.
You have heard their account of what happened? Do you agree with them?
Yes, I do.
The door opened the second time and you went into the house. What did you do then?
I called my wife's name out twice but got no reply. I had some matches with me and went upstairs and looked around and noticed the bedclothes disturbed in the front bedroom. I had not been in there for perhaps 2 weeks.
What did you do next?
I went back downstairs, lit a match and looked into the front room and saw my wife lying there. I thought at first that she'd had a fit, but after I had lit the gas, I could see that she'd been hit. I felt her left hand and felt for a pulse, but there was nothing. I rushed out and told the neighbours what I'd found.
Do you know anything about the piece of iron that was said to be near the gas fire and used for cleaning it?
I know nothing about that at all. I'd never seen it.
How would you describe your demeanour?
I tried to be cool and collected, but I was extremely agitated. I remember smoking cigarettes and him close to breaking down, but do not believe I did so completely.
Is there anyone in the world who could take your wife's place?
No, there is no one.
You gave the police a list of people that your wife might admit to the house?
Yes.
Would she have admitted someone calling himself Qualtro?
I think she might have, as she knew all about the business as well as had talked about it.
Wallace was then cross-examined by Mr. Hemmerid, firstly about his actions on the night of the 20th of January and his local knowledge of the area.
Your superintendent lives in the area of Menlove Gardens, does he not?
Yes, he does.
Did it not occur to you to call at his house to help you find Menlove Gardens East?
I did call, but there was no answer.
What time was that?
I should say at about 7:40.
Just before you met the policeman?
Yes.
Do you accept the suggestion that it would be quite easy for anyone to find out if you were due at the chess club?
Yes, if you were acquainted with the City Café or the Chess Club.
No one could possibly know if you were to be at the café that night. You told no one that you would be there?
That is right.
You had £4 of the Prudential's money, but you would normally have collected between £30 and £40?
Yes.
So anyone familiar with the way your business is done might know that, and if planning a raid on your house and wife would choose the time of the monthly collection...
He might.
As far as you know, did your wife have any enemies?
None whatever.
You know that the call from Mr. Qualtro was made from a box 400 yards from your house?
I understand that is the evidence given.
As he rang the City Café, he must have expected you to be there.
I suppose so.
You were at the café for 2 hours, so he had ample opportunity to call at your house where your wife was alone. Are you suggesting that what he did do... was ring up to make an appointment?
I'm not suggesting that at all.
Has anyone ever left a message for you at the café before?
No, never.
And of course Mr. Qualtro had no way of knowing that you would be there at that night.
Yes.
So without knowing that you had received the message and would go to Menlove Gardens East, he was waiting for you to go there on the night of the 20th?
It would seem like that.
Doesn't the whole thing strike you as remarkable that a man you do not know should ring you up to ask you to go to an address some miles away and not knowing whether you would go there, wait near your house on the chance of murdering your wife?
Yes.
If you had been given the right address, you would need not have made inquiries of several people and thereby established an alibi.
I do not follow you.
Various other witnesses were called. I would summarise their evidence as follows. Professor James Dibble confirmed that rigor mortis is an unreliable method of calculating the time of death. It might be accelerated by the age and physical condition of Mrs. Wallace. If he were in Professor McFall's position at 10 p.m, he would have estimated the death as 3 or 4 hours previously, i.e. between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. The rectal body temperature should be taken as an additional factor. This was not done in this case. Alison Widman, a 16-year-old paper girl, stated that she had been delivering newspapers in Wolverton Street and had seen Close, the milk boy, standing on the doorstep of number 25 at 6:37 p.m. She had passed the Trinity Church clock at 6:35 and took 2 minutes to reach Wolverton Street. Douglas Metcalf, another paper boy, said that he had spoken to Close on the night after the murder, and he had told him that he had seen Mrs. Wallace alive at 6:45. Kenneth Caird, another boy, also said that Close had told him that he had seen Mrs. Wallace at 6:45. Louisa Harrison. Wallace had called on her for 3 years as a prudential agent and had called at 3:30 on the afternoon of the murder. She had asked if Wallace looked as if he had been crying and wiping his eyes. She said that he had been joking with her. Amy Lawrence also said that Wallace had called that afternoon and acted perfectly normally. That completed the case for the defence. The closing statement for the defence. Mr. Oliver then addressed the jury and stated firstly that there were two key issues. One, who made the phone call? He reminded the jury of the evidence given by Mr. Beattie and put it to them that based on that, they could not possibly conclude that it had been the defendant. Two, at what time was Mrs. Wallace last seen alive? The police case was based on the evidence given by the milk boy, Alan Close, who stated in court that he had seen her at 6:30. Mr. Oliver referred to the evidence given by Alison Widman, Douglas Metcalf and Kenneth Cade, which suggested that it could have been several minutes later, which of course would have made it impossible for Wallace to have committed the murder, changed his clothes, washed off any blood, fabricated a theft, and been on the tram at 7:06 p.m. Why should their evidence be less reliable than that of Alan Close? He also covered other aspects of the evidence, and in particular the absence of a motive and the lack of reliable medical evidence concerning the time of death. He wound up his address as follows.
Members of the jury, I have finished. The burden of proof is wholly on the Crown. You have got a crime here without a motive. A man against whose character not a word can be said. A man whose affection for his wife cannot be doubted. You are trying a man for the murder of his wife, his only companion, for no benefit. As the Romans put it, no man suddenly became the basest of men. Looking at the two stories, you may say that the defence does not sound likely, but the story of the prosecution does not sound very likely either. If that is what you think, then he should be acquitted. I suggest this should be the state of your minds. The story for the defence does not sound likely, but it is at least consistent with the facts. The story for the prosecution sounds impossible.
It is a common fallacy, no doubt fostered by films, that the defence has the last word, but that is not in fact the case. The prosecution has the option of replying, which in this case Mr. Hemerid took. He began by addressing the two key issues, which I have summarised. One, The telephone call. The defendant stated that he left home on the 19th at 7:15. That could be a couple of minutes either way. It is a walk of 4 minutes to the telephone box from where the call was made at 7:20. So the defendant would be there at the same time as the man says he made the call. A man who supposedly planning a murder the next night had no way of knowing whether he would receive the message, whether he would act upon it, or would make inquiries in advance and establish that there was no such address as Menlove Gardens East. Remember that by his own admission, the defendant was the only person who knew that he would definitely be at the club to receive the message. He suggested that it was not difficult to disguise a voice, a gruff, confident voice. The jury may have tried it themselves and found it easy. 2. The time of death. Evidence had been given by Alan Close that he saw Mrs. Wallace at 6:30. Others have cast doubt on that and suggest that it may have been a few minutes later. Either way, we know that he was on the tram at 7:06. He suggested that this was sufficient time for the murder to be committed, for signs of disturbance to be created, and for the defendant to change and leave the house, having made the necessary planning and preparation. He went on to make other points, the defendant denying any knowledge of the area around Menlove Avenue, when he had been there several times for violin lessons. His repeated asking for directions on the 20th, when he had been told several times that there was no such address. His conversation with Mr. Beattie 3 days later concerning the time of the phone call and the business, with the door locks when he returned home. He concluded, and the judge, after a short adjournment, began his summing up.
The crime of murder means the premeditated, deliberate, wrongful and felonious killing of another person. In this case, there was no doubt that a murder had been committed, the victim having been struck on the head 11 times in a frenzied attack. There could be no question of insanity, which in any case can only be raised by the defence, as the murder had been planned by the making of a phone call on the previous day. I remind the jury to base your decision solely on the evidence placed before you, and not to be swayed by anything you may have heard or read elsewhere. This murder, I imagine, must be almost unexampled in the annals of crime. Here you have a murder committed sometime in the evening in January in a populous neighbourhood, in a house, and that murder so devised and arranged that nothing remains that could point to anyone as the murderer. No sign of anyone entering the house forcibly, no fingerprints, no marks of blood anywhere in the house apart from around the body and a small spot in the lavatory. No weapon can be traced and no apparent motive in any human being. In many cases of murder, the only evidence is circumstantial. But such evidence can vary enormously in value. In some cases, it can be as good as an eyewitness. In others, it leaves room for loopholes and doubt. The real test is, does it exclude other theories or possibilities? If it does not, it would be impossible for a jury to find the accused guilty beyond all reasonable doubt. The question is not, who did this crime? The question is it proved beyond reasonable doubt that the prisoner did it? Looking at the evidence concerning motive, I do not think I can say anything at all. All the evidence suggests that the prisoner and his wife were living in happiness and amity. There was no financial motive, a small insurance policy with £20 on his wife's life, and she had £90 in the bank account. But the prisoner himself had his own account containing £152. Turning to the relevant facts, and firstly the phone call, which we know was made at 7:20 p.m. on the 19th of January, from a phone box some 400 yards from the prisoner's house. Whoever sent that message must have known a great deal about the prisoner's habits and his intention to be at the chess club. But this knowledge was not limited to the prisoner, as we know that a notice in the chess Club showed that he was due to be there that evening. There is also the question of the voice of the caller, described as gruff, strong and confident. It is hard to imagine that Mr. Beatty would not be able to recognise the prisoner's voice, even if disguised. Now, let us consider the time available to the prisoner if he was the murderer. If you conclude that the time available made it impossible, or at any rate improbable, for him to have committed the murder, then that will assist you in determining his guilt or otherwise. These times are not at all precise. But one time is, and that is that he boarded the tram at Lodge Lane at 7:06. Various experiments were carried out by the police, which gave a variety of times between 15 and 20 minutes to travel from his house to Lodge Lane. This enabled you to fix the time that he left his house between 6:44 and 6:49. The case for the prosecution was based on the evidence of Close, the milk boy, an intelligent boy and apparently an honest witness. He said that he looked at the clock as he left home and it was 6:25. He then walked 500 yards, left the milk, went next door to the Johnsons, and then saw the victim. If therefore you think the likely time was 6:35, then this leaves a very narrow window of time to 6:44 or 6:49 for the prisoner to complete all that he is accused of doing. You will have to consider very carefully whether he could, within 10 minutes, have carried out all that he would have to do, and 20 minutes later be fully dressed and seemingly composed at the tram stop. The suggestion is, of course, that he had planned and executed his crime and therefore carried it out with precision and rapidity. I do not think that you will find the medical evidence of great assistance in determining the time of death. All the medical experts allowed a margin either side of their opinion that the death was around 6 p.m. In one case, a margin of up to 2 hours either side. Now the weapon. None has been found. Mrs. Draper gave evidence that the poker and iron bar are missing, but her last visit to the house was on the 7th of January, some 13 days before the murder. You must consider whether this affords you any clue as to whether the prisoner used either of these items. He cannot have used both. The prosecution questioned the activities of the prisoner between leaving his house at around 6:45 and returning at 8:45 on the 20th, and his asking several people the whereabouts of Menlove Gardens East, even after being told on several occasions there was no such address. Mr. Hemmerid pointed out with some force that this was foolish behaviour, unless the intention was to create a clear alibi. The prisoner was also very prompt. In fact, that very evening he gave police the information necessary to trace the witnesses. On the other hand, you may conclude that obtaining new insurance business is a lucrative thing, as he was merely diligently pursuing this opportunity. In conclusion, I remind you that the question for you is this. Can you have any doubt that the prisoner did it? You may think someone did it. Human nature is very strange. You may have sent a man a bogus message, and having sent that message, see the man leaving the house to go to the door and be admitted by Mrs. Wallace. The prisoner has said that he had told his wife about the interview with Qualtro. Having gained entry, he could see whether the prisoner was at home, and if he was, leave. It's difficult to conceive what the motive might have been, and indeed difficult to conceive what the motive might have been on the part of the prisoner. Either way, whoever committed this crime got away without leaving any trace whatsoever. However you regard the matter, the whole crime was so cleverly devised and executed, and there is such an absence of any trace to incriminate anybody, that it is very difficult for you to say, although it is entirely a matter for you, that it can be brought home to anybody in particular. If there was an unknown murderer, he has covered his traces. Can you say that it is impossible there was no such person? If you are not satisfied, whatever your feelings, surmises, prejudices or suspicions may be, by the evidence put before you, then it is your duty to find the prisoner not guilty. On the other hand, if you are so satisfied, then you must find him guilty. Will you now retire and consider your verdict?
At this point, you may wish to pause the recording and consider what, given the evidence, your verdict would have been. The jury returned after 1 hour. I have known some very tense times in the family court as the decision is about to be pronounced, but the tension in capital cases must have been palpable. The foreman of the jury stood.
Gentlemen of the jury, are you agreed on your verdict?
We are.
Do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty of murder?
Guilty.
You say that he is guilty. Is that the verdict of you all?
It is.
Prisoner at the bar, you have been arraigned on a charge of murder and have placed yourself on your country. That country has now found you guilty. Have you anything to say why judgment of death should not be pronounced upon you, and that you should not die according to the law?
I am not guilty. I don't want to say anything else.
William Herbert Wallace, the jury, after a very careful hearing, have found you guilty of the murder of your wife. For the crime of murder, by the law of this country, there is only one sentence, and that is the sentence I now pass upon you. It is that you be taken from hence to a place of lawful execution, and there you be hanged by the neck until you be dead, and that your body afterwards be buried in the precincts of the prison in which you were last confined. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. Take him down.
Wallace was taken to Warton Prison and placed in the condemned cell under the constant supervision of two warders. His legal team considered on what grounds they could appeal. Grounds for appeal could be that the trial had been unfair, or that the judge had misdirected the jury, neither of which had happened in this case. The judge's summing up had been a model, and if anything, should have led the jury to a not guilty verdict. The guilty verdict was received with muted surprise in court. Had the jury taken against Wallace because of his rather aloof and cold manner in court? Who knows? Jury room discussions like those in the doctor's surgery or the confessional remain confidential. There had also been considerable coverage of the case in the press, and although some of the jury were from outside Liverpool, it's possible that some were prejudiced by local opinion. Seems to me that the old adage of innocent until proven guilty was often reversed among the general public. Heaven only knows what the Twitterati would have been saying had today's means of communication been around then. The Court of Appeal had never allowed an appeal on the basis that the verdict was simply wrong based on the evidence placed before it. In other words, Wallace's guilt had not been proved beyond reasonable doubt. Nevertheless, this was the basis of the appeal, heard on the 18th and 19th of May, before the Lord Chief Justice, Lord Hewitt, and two other appeal court judges. Wallace was transferred from Walton to Pentonville for the hearing. Counsel for the prosecution and defence presented their arguments to the court, and the appeal judges considered their decision. The Lord Chief Justice delivered their judgment.
The appellant William Herbert Wallace was charged at Liverpool Assizes with the murder of his wife on the 20th of January. He was convicted and sentenced to death on the 25th of April. He now appeals against that conviction. Three facts are obvious. The first is that at the conclusion of the case for the Crown, no submission was made for the appellant that there was no case to go to jury. The second fact, that seems obvious to us is that the evidence was summed up with complete fairness and accuracy by the learned judge, and it would have been not at all surprising if the result had been the acquittal of the prisoner. The third obvious fact is that the case is eminently one of difficulty and doubt. Now, the whole of the material evidence has been closely and critically examined before us, and it does not appear to be necessary to discuss it again. Suffice it to say that we are not concerned here with suspicion, however grave, or with theories, however ingenious. Section 4 of the Criminal Appeal Act of 1907 provides that the Court of Criminal Appeal shall allow the appeal if they think that the verdict of the jury should be set aside on the ground that it cannot be supported, having regard to the evidence. The conclusion we have arrived at is that the case against the appellant, which we have carefully considered and discussed, was not proved with that certainty which is necessary in order to justify a verdict of guilty, and therefore it is our duty to take that course which is indicated in the statute to which I referred. The result is that the appeal will be allowed and the conviction squashed.
It is hard to imagine Wallace's thoughts as he listened to the decision, knowing that he would in the near future either be a free man or dead. After release, he returned to Liverpool and to an office-based job with the Prudential. However, he met with considerable hostility, so much so that he moved to Bromborough in the Wirral, where he lived until his death from kidney problems on the 26th of February, 1933. For some of this time, he kept a diary, recalling fondly his life with Julia and their evenings together playing music. He also claimed that he knew the identity of her killer. So, if Wallace did not kill his wife, then who did? Various theories have been put forward over the years. Writing in October 2013, the novelist P.D. James concluded that Wallace did kill his wife using an iron poker and wearing the mackintosh on which the body was lying. She concludes that it was perfectly possible for Wallace to have committed the crime within the timescales involved. Others have suggested that the killer was someone called Richard Gordon Parry, who had worked with Wallace at the Prudential and had stood in for him whilst he was ill in 1928. It seems that Parry did not hand in all the premiums he collected, but he was not reported to the company by Wallace. Parry was interviewed by the police, but provided an alibi supplied by a young lady to whom he was engaged. After Parry broke this engagement off, the lady offered to give evidence that the alibi was false. Other evidence pointed to Parry having taken his car to a garage to be steam cleaned on the night of the murder, and it was noticed that one of his gloves was covered in blood. Parry knew Julia Wallace and could easily have gained access to the house on a pretense. The police seemed to have accepted his alibi at face value in their anxiety to charge Wallace. Parry died in 1980, having not made any admission to the crime. Another theory was that Wallace named the killer to a man who visited him after his conviction. He was known as a dubious character, but was the son of a prominent person in local politics, and a cover-up took place. So, the mystery remains. Was it the perfect murder committed by Wallace? Or was it someone else? We will never know. Kate Matthews, can I help you? Thank you.
play was recorded with the following cast. Kate Matthews was played by Margaret Baldwin, William Wallace by Gordon Stewart, Samuel Beatty by Richard Worrell, Mrs. Johnson, Jeanette Bennett, Edward Hemmerod, Gareth Jones, Roland Oliver, Glyn Rogers, The Judge by Howard Jones, The Lord Chief Justice by David Baldwin, and Clerk to the Assizes by Amanda Watkins. Other parts were played by members of the company. The play was recorded and produced by Dave Baldwin.